From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and you're listening to the smooth sounds of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter Dusing, and with me is the sexually deviant, I don't know, never mind, John Grace.
Howdy, y'all. How about that forced redneck humor?
Welcome, y'all, Midnight Movie Cowboys.
Which was a mandatory thing for this movie, for a Charles B. Pierce trademark.
Yes, indeed. Charles B. Pierce, director of...
Legend of Boggy Creek.
Legend of Boggy Creek, The Evictors, Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah. Also a co-writer of the Dirty Harry film Sudden Impact.
Really?
Yes.
Nice.
Back because Clint, when he did those Dirty Harry movies, when he did the sequels, they were more like... It seems like the later ones were more like submit your script idea. Like there was more freelance involved. Because Charles Pierce worked on Sudden Impact and... some other, like his vitamin, Clint's vitamin coaches or his prescription, his natural food advisors, whatever the hell they would be, nutritionists, I guess would be the word. They wrote the Deadpool.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
If you go back and look at the credits, and I think it's a Deadpool. I'm pretty sure it is. Maybe it's another one. Maybe I'm wrong. And I'm not going to check IMDb and cheat to be right. But one of his films, if you look at, one, I think it's one of the Dirty Harry movies. You look up the writers, and it's like they authored some mega vitamin book in the 70s, and their client, you know, was not named in the book, but it was Clint Eastwood. They were mega dosing him on, you know, various vitamins.
It wouldn't surprise me with the Deadpool. That's a crazy movie.
Yeah, and I apparently his nutritionist wrote it.
Jim Carrey as Axl Rose.
Well, you know, hey, leave it to Eastwood to actually pick talent and go, that kid. Well, he's also in Pink Cadillac for like 2 seconds.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't because Deadpool was pretty much directed by Eastwood because it was directed by that guy who
Buddy Van Horn, who's like the unit guy in everything.
Who's basically when you see Buddy Van Horn's name, it's a Clint Eastwood picture, you know?
Right, right. And it has all his trademarks and stuff. Mm. But that was like the feeling of watching the Deadpool was like if Dirty Harry was like a TV show.
Yeah, it really was.
The season premiere, you know.
It has a very, televisual feel. The sort of natural progression of these old, like, action stars, like, with the, you know, not to denigrate it, but, like, the Death Wish movies kind of have that progression where they just get less and less in quality.
Yeah, and it's funny because they had the better directors with J. Lee Thompson.
Yeah.
Although it's actually one of the more watchable sequels nowadays.
You know Stu's going to make us do a Death Wish show sometime soon. Mm,
I dread that.
I know, it's going to happen.
I'm the podcast that dreaded doing Death Wish. The funny thing is, to add insult to injury about Deadpool, it's in full frame on DVD, at least my DVD.
What about, because I know it's on Blu-ray now, too.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you get a Blu-ray with an anamorphic, but I bought at that time, you could get most of the Dirty Harry's, I think you get all of them at Walmart for nothing.
Yeah, pretty much.
For like $4 and on the old snap cases that Warner Brothers started with. Mm. They were basically anamorphic Laserdisc transfers. The Deadpool was famously full frame.
Bummer, dude.
And it loses nothing because it was basically shot for the TV.
I think I saw it on Netflix Instant, and... I think it was in full frame. I can't remember. But mm-hmm. I remember thinking it wasn't terribly cinematic.
No, it's not. Actually, I don't think any of the sequels are really worthy of the originals. So.
But it's funny because Charles B. Pierce, who directed the movie we're talking about today, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, he was like a regional filmmaker. Like,
yeah.
He was from Texarkana.
Arkansas. Yeah, he used to be a – he was a children's show host.
Yeah, he was in Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
I believe. He was like a weatherman, and then he hosted a children's show, and he was like a set decorator. And he was just kind of a local guy working in that regional film scene. Must have been tiny at the time.
Yeah, he made a forge. Well, actually, regional filmmaking was more common in the 60s and 70s because you had the drive-in market and that kind of secondary theatrical market that mm-hmm. kind of fed this stuff. And,
right.
Like, Legend of Boggy Creek, I think, is G-rated. Yeah, it's
yes,
G-rated.
It is. It's a G-rated. Town That Dreaded Sundown got an R.
Yeah. Legend of Boggy Creek was, like, made for kids. It was, mm-hmm. like, that children were the big market because Bigfoot was a big kiddie thing. you know. And that, I think that movie actually kicked it off. It was the first movie to cash in on the Patterson footage of the guy in the suit.
And it was kind of had that docudrama feel.
Yeah,
kind of like,
because it was all based on the Arkansas version of Bigfoot, which was, I forget what it was, but supposedly true. And
the documentary, the docu Bigfoot movie, was kind of a thing after that.
Yeah, like, it boomed because Legend of Boggy Creek made a fortune. It was one of the biggest hits of that era.
Bobcat Goldthwait just directed like a parody of like those Bigfoot movies, the docu Bigfoot movies. He made one. And he did it with, like, in the Bigfoot conspiracy community. Like, he used a lot of those real people. Yeah. He got really into that Bigfoot culture and made this Bigfoot movie.
Yeah, I didn't even know that culture was still around.
After yeah, apparently it is.
The Patterson movie, I thought, was thoroughly debunked. And, you know, after the 70s, a lot of that stuff, it was like, oh, yeah, we admit, we were screwing with the construction crew and went out with the big footprints and made the tracks and... Like, I thought all that stuff was debunked, but I guess you still got the faithful who don't want to give up.
Yeah, they he's out there, man.
Can't let go of Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. Ain't going to let go of Bigfoot. You know?
I want to believe. You know.
Well, the funny thing is, Legend of Boggy Creek was such a big hit that the screenwriter who co-wrote it with Pierce or whatever wrote the book about the monster. Friend of mine actually got in touch with him because he was trying to see about researching special features for a potential Boggy Creek, like, special edition DVD that never happened. But the guy would not talk about Charles B. Pierce. He goes, "Now, I ain't wishing any ill on the man, but that's about all I got to say about Charles B. Pierce." Because apparently he made a fortune off Boggy Creek and didn't spread the wealth, you know.
I see.
Right. But Town of the Dreaded Sundown was part of a deal he had made with AIP, where he would produce the films in Arkansas. AIP would distribute them nationally.
Yeah, because Samuel Z. Arkoff is the name the name of the producer on this movie.
Right.
Samuel Z. Arkoff presents.
Yeah, it was big name since the 50s in terms of distributing this stuff and producing this stuff. And that was back when these a company like AIP would give money, you know, would finance the budget or do a pickup of – you know, originally made film, if it was slick enough and looked good enough to release in, you know, nationally. And back then they would do regional releasing. Mm-hmm. Like, this opened huge in New Orleans when I was a kid. I was like 4.
Yeah.
And what they would do back then is they would buy advertising on the local stations, like the distributor would.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the system was they would rent out the theater for like 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they rent out the theater at least the first week, and if it was a huge hit, you know, they might rent a second week.
So but this is like that.
And they only had like a certain amount of prints to go around regionally.
Right.
And I talked to my friend Dan, said he remembers what it played up north. So it did play around the country, but in New Orleans is a big deal because Texarkana is what a 5-6 hour drive. You know?
Yeah.
So, There's a little creepy factor there, you know.
Texarkana was always the place I passed through, so it was interesting
funny
to learn that there was this movie about this true story about this killer. It's funny, we did that Eurons episode with Cameron Cloutier. When I posted about this on Facebook, he liked the post, so I was like, of course he does. But this is our second show, like, in a month about an unsolved serial killer movie.
Yeah. Well, this one is actually released and was a hit, I think. Like, I think it did pretty well for what this type of movie was expected to do back then.
Well, it's just funny because before this movie finally got a video release from Scream Factory, which is – this is one of their most essential releases.
Yeah, it's the only one I've purchased so far.
I remember a lot of people had a lot of love for this movie and were wanting it badly to come out on DVD because a lot of people in your age range, because they remembered seeing it on TV, they remembered seeing it in the theater, and it's scaring the shit out of them.
Yeah.
You know, and apparently every year in October, they have a special outdoor screening of it in Texarkana.
Well, what I remember was when it played in New Orleans, the ads ran on TV in the late afternoon, early evening, which you really – back then – okay, during the slasher movie boom of the 80s that everybody fondly looks back on for some reason, they wouldn't allow ads for a lot of those movies to play during those hours because they're too intense. Little kids would see them and the station would get complaints.
Mm.
And because, you know, back then, stay-at-home moms, you know, moms stayed home, kids would run around the house, so it was like mom would have the TV on and that ad would come on. You wouldn't see those ads till like after 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., depending on where you live.
Sure.
The Town of the Dreaded Sundown, the ads ran all the time. Like, they ran it like crazy, and they were violent TV ads. Like, here's a hooded killer, he's got a gun, and there's the guy sitting in his chair, and he's outside in the window, just pulls the gun out in slow motion, and they made it even look worse on TV. You know?
I mean, like, when you're a kid, the idea of seeing a hooded figure outside
this
your
window... This is before Halloween and Friday the 13th and all that stuff.
Oh, this, yeah, this was 76, this came
all
out.
All of that. And the ads would end with, he was never caught. And that was like every TV ad. It's like
that's just what kids need is like the boogeyman. And like Charles Pierce said that, I heard that Charles Pierce wanted to make this because that was like Texarkana's boogeyman. Like he was told stories about that guy when he was a little kid. This hooded killer. Although, I don't know. I think the hood was like part of the movie. Nobody really could positively identify. I think the first couple that was attacked. Mm-hmm. That survived. The man and the woman had very different accounts of what the guy looked like.
Yeah, but, and it's funny. Okay, this is odd because like 12 years ago when I first thought about this case, and I'm like, was that real? And I looked it up and found a website about it, the wonders of the internet. Because this case is not really that well known outside of the movie.
And I wouldn't have known about it if it wasn't for this movie.
Right, you know, there's never been a best-selling book about it or anything. I wanted to see what the real thing of the case was. And back then, they said he didn't wear a hood. Nowadays, I read true crime sites, and they said one attack he did wear a hood. And that's where the idea. And I, you know, these days it's kind of like with Aaron's, what really happened and what didn't. What was, you know, what was the telephone game where it got more exaggerated?
Right. On the Blu-ray, there's a commentary track with a historian who knows a lot about the case. His name is. Jim Presley.
Yeah.
And him and Justin Beam are on the track. Justin's kind of asking him questions and occasionally interjects with trivia and stuff about the movie. Mm-hmm. But the guy, he's like an old dude, like one of those old local historians, you know, kind of a Shelby Foote type, I guess.
Right, right.
Texarkana.
One of those guys who probably lives in a restored home and wears suspenders. And,
yeah.
You know, takes you around the house and shows you the copper bathtub.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I highly recommend listening to it. The movie's not very long, so it's not a strenuous...
I listened to it back when I got the Blu-ray. I probably should have listened to it again before this show, but I just didn't have the time.
But he said, like, the first couple that was attacked, the girl said he was wearing a mask or, like, a black mask. He might have been black or might have been wearing a black mask. And the guy who was attacked said he was white. Apparently, he was carrying a flashlight, and, you know, they were both being violently beaten, so it's kind of hard to tell. And
Right, they couldn't tell. Yeah, but I think the movie pretty much does the whole ghostly white mask.
Mm-hmm. And
which was ripped off by Friday the 13th Part 2.
You beat me to it. I was about to say that. The potato
like blatant, like even when I was a kid, I knew they were ripping that off, you know. Like when I first saw the photos of Friday the 13th Part 2 and Famous Monsters before they went out of business, but they had the beer. I was like, well, it looks like the Town of the Dreaded Sundown.
Yep.
And then in the mid-80s, Chaz Ballin had talked about it as an influential to the slashers, but when I watch the film, I think it's a lot better than that.
Oh, totally. It does have like some of the sort of creative ways of killing people. Mm-hmm. The trombone death being...
Which did not happen in real life.
No, it did. He killed everybody with a gun. He did not stab anybody to death.
Yeah, he wasn't a stylized killer like the movies portray.
One thing the movie does really well, I like that it kind of sets up what Texarkana was like at the time, this post-war.
It does an amazing job of that. I think it does a better job of that than Mad Men does with New York in the early 60s.
I mean, it's because that's stuff that's really important when you consider, you have to consider the climate of the time when you think about these true crime things. What was going on? Like, what was the town like? You know, people don't think about that stuff, and movies often don't think about that stuff. And you have that narration at the beginning that sets the scene for the town. I mean, the town's pretty, like, you know, you have our characters like the cops and stuff, but the town's really like a big part of it, just because you hop from all these character to character, you know, and we get all this stuff in between, like, oh, people were locking up their doors, you know, the locksmiths were out of, you know, being sold out. The movie. We have this opening attack which is actually a very really scary scene where he pops up the hood and slams it down. You see this guy wearing a hood. It's pops up the hood of the car. And you see a man wearing a hood. I didn't word that too well. The cops immediately, like, the next time it rains, they go, oh, maybe we should go patrolling. The first and second attacks weren't even connected until the third attack.
Right.
That's when they went, oh, okay, maybe there's something going on here. So, like, by the third attack, the cops are, which this did happen, the cops are dressing up like couples, like some of them are in drag.
Yeah, which led to a lot of the dumb Charles Pierce humor.
That's the big bitch I have about this movie is Charles Pierce is in the movie playing a cop named Sparkplug, and he's the comic relief character, and all the shit with him is horrible.
Yeah. When I first saw this movie, of course, did not see it in the theater when I was four. I probably wouldn't be alive today if that were the case. I saw it on Warner Home Video, had one of the big old ugly Warner Brothers clamshell box, as me and Stu, I think, discussed on the old VHS show. We rented The Town That Dreaded Sundown. I think it was like 12 when I saw it, or 13.
Perfect
and
age.
The attack scenes were pretty intense, even by 1985 or 86 standards when I saw it. It was pretty freaky. But then when the spark plug stuff, I was like, what is this crap?
You know what it reminds me of later on is the, I think Wes Craven must have been watching that when he made Last House on the Left.
Well, that predated Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Oh, it did? I thought it came after.
No, it predated, like, Last House was like 71, 72.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought it was like 79.
Oh, no. 76, it was Town That Dreaded Sundown. It's really what it was just responding to the market. Like, Charles Pierce knew his market around the South, and he knew that they would want a movie with scares, but they'd want some silly, stupid, you know, like, country bumpkin comedy.
Like, oh, I just drove my car into the swamp.
Right. Like, because, you know, the Burt Reynolds movies were starting to get big at the time, like Gator and Smokey and the Bandit wasn't out by then.
It didn't come out till
Gator and that whole Southern humor thing was almost like, was still kind of accepted in drive-in movies. Nowadays, we would say, okay, save it for the Toby Keith straight-to-video movie.
Oh,
but
man.
Back then, that was an essential commercial element and something that was going to play in drive-ins around the South.
Now, don't you threaten
right
anybody who calls in.
Remember, it's not really a horror film. It's really like a true crime documentary.
That was kind of a big thing with like those drive-in movies at the time was like, let's get a rip from the headlines like story. It's based on a true story.
Right. It's like it's a suspense, like crime thriller docudrama. It's not really a horror film. There's really, I don't even recall much gore in it. You know, most of the violence is implied, and
the
it's
only like gory bit was the shooting it with the home invasion sequence where
which is an incredibly intense scene. And you know they didn't even have like the money that they have today to do this stuff, and they can't even do it well. Like Rob Zombie has Michael Myers charging through a house.
Oh, he smashes the wall down. You know,
and it looks like some WWE promotion video for Kane. Doesn't even strike you as believable or real. And that home invasion scene in The Town That Dreaded Sundown is incredibly frightening and realistic.
It's so, like, just the guy, oh, did you hear something? I didn't hear nothing.
Yeah. It's just so, that's a strange thing about Charles Pierce is, you know, this is not a guy who's, like, went to USC with Carpenter and Milius and Lucas and studied all the greats. He's probably just a guy who just kind of memorized the best bits from Hitchcock movies and developed his own theories about what is suspenseful and what is frightening.
I am living alone for the first time in my life.
Uh-huh.
And I was always worried, like, because of scenes like this, living at a house, that I'd get tremendous anxiety at night.
You know, in a weird way, I do not like to sit in the rocking chair with the window
open. There's one window in my...
I cannot do it. It's probably because of that movie.
There's one window in my house I just don't like sitting in front of, and because it's the most exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of... There are other areas of my house where there's like bushes and stuff and I feel safe, but just a window on the ground level that you can see me clearly, and I just don't like hanging out. And it's because of movies like this that fuck me up, you know?
Well, then it's like, it's interesting because there's a, when the, as the crimes kind of happen early on, and you get that the way it builds, and then it basically becomes a Ben Johnson movie. Because Ben Johnson comes in as a sort of stand-in for, was he actually named, I don't think he was called, was he, directly, okay, they called him J.D. Morales.
They call him Morales, and he was actually, but the guy's name was like Gonzalez or something. I can't remember.
Yeah, he was Gonzalez, who was also the inspiration for the Chuck Norris film Lone Wolf McQuade, real guy.
Yeah, it was funny
he was a one-man, one riot. He infamously showed up at a riot, and they said, they only sent one Texas Ranger, and he said, well, you only got one riot. and that became a famous legend quote.
The
J.J. Gonzalez, or whatever the real Texas Ranger's name was, he was like a legend among Texas Rangers. Like, Walker, Texas Ranger, I think, even makes references to it, because, you know, Lone Wolf McQuade was based on the legend. But this is, that's who Ben Johnson is basically portraying. And the coolest scenes are, like, when he's at the train, is a train station or bus station, I forget, but they actually just capture the period perfectly, where the magazines and the newspapers look like 1946 Texarkana.
Oh, and I love the bit where he just goes, let me go get a cigar. He just goes to the cigar stand, and you see, like, the old, because I remember those old cigar boxes at, like, antique stores and stuff.
Yeah, like, I love that stuff. And just, like, he's at the, like, they're at the diner, and he's talking about, like, he's almost giving a profile. He's basically given a psychological profile of the killer, and they're discussing it and everything. Of course, they imply the killer was there that night. An incredibly well-edited scene, but it's funny because I have thought that pretty much serial killer lore as we know it today, with weird goth kids knowing everything about Jeffrey Dahmer, didn't exist back then.
No, it didn't. The term serial killer wasn't even around.
Right. It didn't. It wasn't around. And so the idea that they're dealing with a new type of crime that they never really identified before, you know, I think the earliest they'll think of is something like Jack the Ripper, but I don't think there was any real way of detailing, you know, when you had an offender like this. And I've heard legend has it that they used to, in societies and villages, they would figure out who was weird like that, and they would make them the sheep herder.
Yeah.
That's somebody who needs to go out with the goats to the hills because he's weird, you know, like that's where those guys came from. But, you know, nowadays we don't do that with our oddballs, so, you know.
We should bring that back, John, I think.
You know, we need to bring back straight jacketing or send you to watch the sheep.
I think we need to bring back the sheep herder.
Yeah, I think it was this novel I read years ago called Devil in the White City. It was like a bestseller.
Oh, yeah, I remember that book. Yeah.
I think it kicked around the theory that you know, in older times, they would basically send the weirdo to guard the sheep or whatever. You know, that's who you sent. Just get them away from the people.
Well, and that's one thing in the movie that's pretty inaccurate, is that the cops do intuitively connect the crimes early on.
Or right.
They think it's going to happen again. Like, two people attacked on a lover's lane. Okay, somebody, like, historian in the commentary said someone had a grudge. That's what they thought. They thought somebody was mad at this couple, and they went and beat the shit out of them.
You know?
Like, and then when that second couple was killed, they thought the same thing. Somebody was pissed off, you know?
Right. Because at that time, most of the crimes I knew about, it was either going to be bootlegging, organized crime, or it was going to be, like, crimes of passion or muggings or something.
Texarkana was a rowdier town because it was a border state, you know?
Right.
And today we don't really think much of it, you know? Back then you did have, like, stuff smuggling booze across state lines and stuff like that.
Right, because the idea of the FBI being able to cross state lines to catch criminals was a big deal at the time. That was fairly new.
Yeah.
It was only like a few years old. So it's funny because it does explain, like, kind of shows all that stuff, and there's not a whole lot of it. They were really good at hiding anachronisms, which a lot of things I watch today, when it's set in the 40s or the 50s or 60s, or even the 70s, they can't get it right.
No.
And here, he nailed it. And, of course, because it wasn't that far off. It was in 76.
Yeah.
And not much of Texarkana had changed at that time. You know, this was before they were building a Best Buy and an Applebee's everywhere.
Yeah, now you drive through Texarkana, it's like you'll see Best Buy, Applebee's.
Right.
You know, you'll see Chili's, Sonic. It's just – but then again, I haven't strayed off of I-30 when I go through Texarkana. I only stop there for gas. It's like my stop point to get gas on the way to Memphis, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I spent the night in Texarkana at a truck stop motel on the way to Mississippi, and it didn't even occur to me at all that I was in the town that dreaded sundown. I didn't even think about it.
It's funny.
It wasn't until like a couple of years later I was like, huh? You know?
One of the locations in the movie, the Hotel McCartney, or it's the Hotel Artney in the film, according to the commentary, is still standing, but it's vacant. It's like the eight-story ghost, they call it. It's still sitting there. Yeah. So next time I go up to Memphis, which will be soon, I think, I want to stop and just take a look at it. Just take a gander at this empty
hotel.
Yeah,
and I wish I had spent a little time in that city just kind of looking around, but I didn't even think about it. And I hadn't seen the movie in years.
I had heard that the places where the murders occurred, you know, there's like malls there now and stuff. You know,
wow.
Those fields aren't even there anymore.
That is so weird to think about. I actually wonder, when they did the location work, did they go to the actual locations where those occurred?
That's a good question. I don't think they addressed it.
Charles Pierce wasn't alive to tell us. So.
No, he died in 2010, I think.
apparently, and wasn't really up for doing interviews. I can't really find many interviews.
No, it was Justin Beam even said, you know, he wasn't a guy who talked a lot about his movies in the media. Like, he just nobody ever thought to seek him out, I guess.
That's crazy. That's one of those things I think, okay, when I lived near that area, that's something I should have tried doing. You know, I was like, why didn't I seek out Charles Pearson? But it hadn't even occurred to me. Because you always think somebody else, you know? You think somebody else is going to do it. Oh, I'll leave it to somebody else.
Oh, Fangoria will do it. Somebody, not Fangoria. You'd think in the days of the internet.
Film Facts will do
it.
Remember Film Facts? They'll talk.
Yeah. Well, it's like, and in the days of the internet, there's obscure blogs for everything. You know,
yeah.
Of course, oh, there's going to be some blog devoted to Town That Dreaded Sundown or something.
not only that, but the truth is of the 80s is that his films were disregarded by the Fangoria crowd.
Because the Fangoria crowd, they're a bunch of gore hounds. You know?
Yeah, they like Fulci and
they'd rather
the
watch
stupid Friday the 13th
movies. Part 2 than watch Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Right, they didn't even think about it. And that's the film's following was kind of more built up over the years because it was suddenly realized that Carpenter was inspired by it when he made Halloween. Mm-hmm. And I talked with Ronan Rowe about it. Ronan said that Town That Dreaded Sundown, the idea of the mass killer who didn't talk, was totally used in Halloween. But he said like the idea of the mass killer that showed no emotion, it was just breathing, that was all that inspired Michael Myers. And I mean, of course, it was also Yul Brynner in Westworld was a big inspiration, but the idea,
let's talk
like
about that,
when the breathing and stuff, that was totally inspired into Halloween.
That is one of the creepiest things in that movie. It's the way the mask sucks in and out, just breathing heavily.
And I think that's the first film where a mass killer was portrayed like that. Charles Pierce, for whatever reason, was like kind of an innovator and didn't even realize it.
He wasn't
watching every giallo from Italy, and he'd probably seen one. You know?
That would be funny if like Goblin did the soundtrack or something,
right? And I actually like the score in the film too. It's kind of reminds me, you had those kind of creepy, you know, kind of old school scores,
mm-hmm.
where everybody wanted to do like a Carpenter type score, or now you just get booming symphonies, or if it's a Rob Zombie movie, you just get a bunch of you know, rock remakes.
God of Thunder.
Yeah.
And Rock and Roll.
You know, ironic Skinner music or some nonsense, you know.
Seasons don't fear the Reaper.
Yeah, suddenly Blue Oyster Cult is playing the beach. But also, like, I think something I'd read on one of those true crime pages was that the murder portrayed in the film where what's her name? Don Wells, Marianne from Ginger, you know, Gilligan's Island or whatever.
Yeah, that was insane that she was in this movie.
Right. And apparently she just lived and she was married to a guy and lived in the next state and just flew a little plane over and worked like a day and a half on the movie.
I mean, she's in it for like one scene, but it's one of the best scenes in the movie. It's so scary.
And the cops believed at the time that was not related to the other murders.
No, they didn't, because it didn't match his M.O. His M.O. was murdering people in lovers' lanes. It wasn't breaking into houses.
Right, and they were also thinking that was a hired hit, mm-hmm. and made to look like it was, you know, maybe it was the Phantom Killer or whatever, but it was a hired hit. And I think it's because the widow, that real woman, would not talk about it afterwards.
Well, I mean, that happens with a lot of people, like, you know, there, a lot of these unsolved cases, the people who survived, like Zodiac and stuff, it took forever to get some of those people to talk, you know?
Yeah, and you didn't have these really good, like, criminal investigators who could, you know, get those people to talk about stuff and get the information, you know?
No.
The crime-fighting process wasn't really fully developed the way it is today.
And the guy shot them with a .22, which explains how she was able to survive those wounds.
Right. It was like a .22. But, you know, the .22 is a preferred hitman's weapon.
Why is that?
I don't know specifically why, but I've noticed a lot of the times I've read in both fiction and nonfiction books, hitmen like to use .22s.
That's really strange.
Maybe because they're quiet.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
it is. It's a preferred weapon, but I think because it's quieter, it's easier to conceal if you're trying to look like a regular person. And if you're good aim, you can kill somebody with it. But
and my grandmother has a .22 pistol, and it is it's a little bitty thing, you know.
my grandfather had a .22 rifle that he was just basically used for killing squirrels. He otherwise thought it was useless. And even I thought it was like a BB gun.
Yeah. I mean, .22 rifles were my, you know, when I was like a little kid, that's what I would shoot at the ranch, you know.
Right, right. It's like that's a little kid's gun, but apparently hitmen, I think it's a preferred weapon of hitmen because it doesn't make a lot of noise. And you know, this is back before people built suppressors or buy suppressors for guns.
Well, in the movie, the killer uses a suppressor.
For those of you who don't know guns, I'm talking about a silencer, but it's not really a silencer; it's a suppressor.
Yeah.
Can I tell you about my time at the gun range?
No, what?
We have a gun range. There's a store called The Shootist. I think it was probably seen on A&E or one of those reality shows. Seems like there's 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And I was taking an NRA gun safety class, and
fuck. Why do you like killing children? You must support.
Yeah,
you must support
great.
School
yeah.
shootings.
Suck my Glock, yeah,
yeah. But, you can suck my machine gun, da da da.
Right, and so I'm down in the shooting gallery, and we're shooting targets and stuff under the store. You know, they have like a soundproof basement, and there was this dude who'd ridden up on a motorcycle.
Uh-oh.
He comes out, and he's got like a quick semi-automatic pistol, pretty fancy looking, and it's got a suppressor on it, and he's just going doop. And then he just literally packs it up, puts on his sunglasses, and takes his motorcycle helmet, goes back out to his Honda or Kawasaki or whatever his bike was.
Did the Terminator theme music play?
Yeah, he's like one of the henchmen in a Joel Silver produced action
dun,
movie.
Dun, you know? Dun, dun.
Yeah, he wasn't like a big guy or anything, but he was like kind of like just, you know, strangely normal looking, but he looked like a henchman you'd see out of a movie, but he's just got the gun and going, ba-dum, ba-dum.
You know, that would
it might have been
out.
Like a Desert Eagle, but it had the suppressor on it and everything.
Desert Eagle.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a fancy gun. He looked like a hitman. He put it in a case and he went up to his motorcycle. Maybe he'd get killed by Riggs and Murtaugh later that day.
So this movie had Don Wells from Gilligan's Island. It also had Andrew Prine as like the lead cop in the movie. Not Ben Johnson, but the other guy in the movie.
Right.
And he was in Grizzly.
He was a journeyman B actor, yeah. Simon King of the Witches. That's how I knew him. And he was in V, the miniseries and TV show.
And he was also in another Pierce movie, but I can't remember which one it was.
He might have been in one of his westerns because he did those westerns like Grey Eagle.
Oh yeah, I think it might have been that one. But Ben Johnson's the biggest name.
Oh, Married with Children fans would know Andrew Prine as Psycho Dad when they actually showed him. It was Al Bundy's favorite TV show, and then they had an episode where they tried to pull it, and there's these women are protesting, and I guess Peg is part of the protest, and the actor playing Psycho Dad was played by Andrew Prine, which
that
I thought
wild.
Was an amazing nod to B-movie fans, if that's what it was.
Psycho.
I was like, holy fuck, they found Simon King of the Witches to play Psycho Dad. That is freaking great. That's the most brilliant thing this show has ever done.
Have you watched The Evictors?
Yes.
Comes on the Blu-ray of Town That Dreaded Sundown. I thought it was decent. Not as good as Town That Dreaded Sundown.
It's a Hitchcock William Castle knockoff.
Yeah, it's got an impressive cast, though. You've got Jessica Harper from like movies like Suspiria.
Yeah.
And
she was a big get for that movie. It was a surprise.
And you got Vic Morrow. Our favorite,
right.
Vic Morrow.
Now, his career wasn't doing the best at that time. I think
no,
he just did a message from space over at Toei Studios with Sonny Chiba and Chris Isaac in a Blink If You'll Miss It role.
And, you also had Michael Parks.
Yes, Michael Parks, who was also not a name at the time.
No, not at all.
Was kind of washed up.
He hadn't gotten the revival from Rodriguez, Tarantino.
No, he had become a B-movie actor at the time. He was become another Andrew Prine,
mm-hmm.
like a really good talent that was just kind of being... was only finding like lead work in B-movies.
But it's a film that has a really strong small-town vibe like this one does.
Yes, it does.
You know, I really like the atmosphere of it. It's not as good as this film, but...
I remember when it was released, and the ads were really creepy, and they would run on TV in those, like, Saturday mornings. And Charles Pierce, I think, got his name above the credits. It would be Charles Pierce's The Evictors.
Charles B. Pierce.
Yeah, it was just like, it was kind of like John Carpenter's Halloween. So it's like, okay,
Carpenter.
Maestro of a filmmaker, you got your name above the title. Like that was an early lesson in that. It's funny when I watched that movie that I got some big laughs out of the finale. And it's got some good intense scenes, but there's also some hokey, silly things. But when Vic Morrow goes to the rescue at the end, he like puts his cigarette in his mouth. And holds his gun like Bogart, and like, it's just ridiculous. It's like it's almost like Vic Morrow insisted that he must hold the gun, but he's got to have a cigarette in his mouth like Bogart.
You know, it's insane to me because back when I was a smoker, I couldn't smoke just holding a cigarette in my mouth. My eyes always felt like they were going to burn out of my face if I did that.
If you were Vic Morrow, apparently. But,
I mean, apparently his eyes were just like made of like leather or something.
Well, it's funny because he was on the set of that Message for Space, and Chris Isaac told this story that he basically worked as Vic Morrow's translator. He was like he worked as a tour guide at Toei Studios, like for Americans, and got work on that movie as a translator for Vic Morrow. And he said that Vic Morrow, he kept saying, "I want a laser gun. Why did they give me a normal gun? I want a laser gun." This is a science fiction movie, so the prop person had to go out because they'd give him like a Colt 45 or something, and he was like, "I want a laser gun," and so they had to go find like a laser prop gun for him to use in the film.
He could have used it when he was working with John Landis. He could have defended himself.
Oh, I swear! But the thing is, Vic Morrow was really popular in Japan because Combat was a huge TV show when it aired on Japanese TV.
Really.
They loved it. So Vic
Big
Morrow,
in Japan, baby. That's all you need.
Yeah, it's like Vic Morrow got the role in Message for Space because he was so huge in Japan because of Combat. They loved him. Oh, well, I can tell you this at this movie because all we had for years was that Warner Home Video pan and scan tape. I don't even know if it was pan and scan.
So it was out on VHS.
Yeah, it was a popular VHS rental in the South, at least Southern Video stores, because that was kind of like a, you know, it was, I guess you'd call it a cult movie now, but it was a movie people knew about or remembered, and probably because of those TV ads are so damn effective.
Well,
and you can look them up on YouTube and see it for yourself. I mean, they're scary-ass ads.
This movie was always on lists of, like, underrated movies that never made it to DVD.
Yeah, and then some fan put together, apparently the French either released a DVD or a videotape that was in scope. And the film was shot in scope, not widescreen 1.85. It was in CinemaScope, you know, 2.35:1 ratio, whatever you want to call it. They basically synced up the American home video audio with the French widescreen version. Like, that's how dedicated some fans of this movie were. Like, they wanted that widescreen version. And then when they started airing a new remastered print on TCM, at like for whatever their cult movie night is on Fridays.
Didn't like Rob Zombie host it or something?
He did. I think he did the early ones, and I think they did them without host after that. I might be wrong. I haven't had cable in years, so I don't recall. But I remember my brother was like, I caught half of that movie last night. Man, that was unbelievable. Like, so it was still like people were seeing it and going, man, it still has a lot of power. Like, it's just really effective. And also because it's probably not overdone. So many horror films today are so in your face and overproduced and overdirected.
Overly gory, too. Like,
right. Just, and as I've often bitched, they're shot like action films. They're not shot like horror films.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I saw, like, The Conjuring in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it has that problem where it has this momentum that builds.
Yeah.
And it gets to that sweet spot, but then it keeps going. And then it becomes an action movie, which is one reason I like Scott Derrickson's Sinister so much, because it hits that level of dread and slow and stillness, and it just stays there. It doesn't. There's no bit where like he has to run through the house and, you know, everything's falling apart, and, you know, like the end of Insidious or something.
Right.
You know how
in Insidious it was like beat the clock and Freddy Krueger type stuff, and
Insidious, like it. There was that period in Insidious where it was pretty scary and pretty good. And the
first 45 minutes of Insidious are great.
Like, Sinister feels like the first 45 minutes of Insidious, but the whole movie.
Okay.
It's the only recent horror movie that I think is, like, classic. Like, just really good.
Well, the strangest thing is they're remaking The Town of the Dreaded Sundown, but they're doing it like it's set during one of the revival screenings that they do.
Oh gosh.
So it's another postmodern, you know.
And
basically
Ryan Murphy,
Wes Craven's new
it?
Nightmare done to death, you know.
Isn't Ryan Murphy involved with it or something?
I believe so, and I've never seen his work, as I've often complained I don't watch new horror films and don't care.
Ryan Murphy's the guy who did Glee and Eat Pray Love.
Yeah, it's like, "Oh, this is total sign of quality."
Yeah. I mean, just some of the worst shit in culture right now.
The problem is, Charles Pierce was a raw talent, and when he made this, like, maybe you could say it was accidentally great, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I don't know if I call it a great movie, but it's really, really good.
I don't think it's a great film. It has problems, like the humor and stuff hasn't aged well.
The humor's terrible. Also, the action ending that Andrew Prine claims he wrote because he didn't have an ending with the train chase, the chase by the train, which was kind of to give the audiences a satisfied, okay, we can go home because he probably died in the swamp type of thing.
Yeah.
And it never happened.
No.
They never had a shootout with this guy.
No. In the commentary, they said that never happened. They said that there was a suspect that they had that they thought might have done it, but because he said something suspicious, like he was caught stealing a car.
And right. Ewell Swinney was his name.
Yeah, and stolen cars were involved in all these crimes. And when they arrested him, they said, you know, arrested for stolen car. He goes, you know, you got me for more than that. And but he stayed mum until his death in like 1990.
Well, I had heard like there was boasting to cellmates and there was like,
yes.
I guess he had a girlfriend who knew things that she wouldn't have known if she wasn't involved or something like that. You know, my memory's blurred on all the stuff I'd read about this case. But apparently one of the writers who worked on a book about the murders, and I think they called it the Moonlight Murders or something.
Yeah, he was the Moonlight Killer.
Yeah, but, and I think of it as the Phantom Killer just because of the movie, really. But he actually interviewed Ewell Swinney at like his retirement home and he asked him about it. And he said the guy gave him an answer. Everybody knows I had nothing to do with that. So he said, but the answer he gave like just scared the hell out of him. Like he just looked at him in a certain way or it was a freaky answer.
But we all know what really happened to the Texarkana Moonlight Killer, though. He was
He became Zodiac. Actually one of the theories.
There was a theory that he was also the Black Dahlia killer too.
Yeah.
But no, he was actually murdered by Tom Waits and his black girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
Did you ever see Seven Psychopaths?
No.
Oh, there's this. It's a movie about this guy writing a script about psychopaths, and Sam Rockwell puts an ad for. Are you a psychopath? And you need to come talk to my screenwriter friend. And
so it's like a California ripoff then.
That's only a very small part of the movie, but so Tom Waits shows up and he starts talking about how he, you know, saved this black girl from being killed and they fell in love and they became serial killer killers. And there's this montage of them murdering, unsolved serial killers. They're like making out in a car and then the hooded guy from the movie pops up and they drop acid on him and set him on fire and shoot him several times.
My gosh.
And they also kill Zodiac and the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run.
Well, somebody had written that they think the Phantom Killer case had actually inspired the Hookman urban legend.
Oh, the Hookman.
Of the couple getting attacked.
You know, that persisted to when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard that story all the time growing up, that the scratching outside. That's so wild. Oh, I hadn't even thought about that.
I had heard the story, believe it or not, I'd heard the story reformed into a Bigfoot story in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yes, it had turned into a Bigfoot version of it.
That is
so funny.
But
I heard the scratching thing. But, you know, when I thought scratching, I was like, well, somebody had their nails and they rolled the hood. You know, because as a kid, I was very literal about words. I didn't think, a hook was scratched. They forgot to mention it sounded like a hook scratching the trunk.
There was a hook in the car.
Yeah, but they said this was supposedly the case that inspired that. I don't know about that. I don't know if you can really prove that.
I don't know if you could prove it, but there are similarities. Certainly the couples making out in the cars. And
right, and the similarity to Zodiac is certainly striking enough where you would say, okay, but maybe they were the only Lovers Lane killers, you know, but Carol Chessman in... Los Angeles, I think, attack couples that way.
Mm.
He attacked couples at Lover's Lane, and he was, like, I think, executed by the state. But because he had written some books, people were thinking, well, he probably should be executed. He obviously had a brain or something. I was like,
oh,
whatever.
Oh, it's like the guy who Tookie Williams or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's a reformed man.
I just like that Schwarzenegger, like, no, execute him.
Yeah. I remember that.
Damn
was,
it, you created the gangsters.
Oh, everybody at my school was so mad when he killed him.
I was glad. I was like, that was one good thing he did. Like, damn it, pull the trigger.
Yes, jam the needle in his arm.
Yeah, he write the children's book. I can write the children's book. I'll make a children's movie.
Tookie, I'll see you in hell.
The only people I've seen defending Carl Chessman would be like Merle Haggard, who I think was one on his A&E biography because he was a cellmate in California. He's like, well, he didn't kill nobody. Yeah, he was only like a brutal rapist and assaulter. Okay. Well,
what was it? Everybody was really mad about that guy who there was a botched lethal injection in Oklahoma. And
who cares? They could all be botched for all I care.
Oh, well, they were so mad about it. But what was it? John Derbyshire brought it up on his podcast this week.
Yeah.
And then he read the guy's crimes, and it was like
they buried a woman alive.
Yeah, they shot this woman and buried her alive after like raping her and her friends. It was like Last House on the Left times 1,000. It was,
and I see the type of emasculated liberals talking about that sort of stuff, and like it's important. I'm like, it doesn't matter what this is nobody's talked about the death penalty in a long time in the national media to make it an issue. Like, to get the president's attention or get the world's attention. And the truth is, it hasn't been done since Timothy McVeigh's execution, which McVeigh requested.
Yes.
And there was a small protest there, and that's the last I've heard about the death penalty on a national level. And, or you know, they like to put down a presidential candidate because his state executed so many people. I was like, well, that's a reason to vote for. It's like, because that's a guy who knows how to get things done. It's like,
yeah,
I remember Charles Barkley said on TV, you know, back when he was pushing himself as some sort of hardcore conservative, he was like, shouldn't be no death row, should be death week. I like that. I like it when Barkley laid it down like that. I don't know if he said it was terrible. Death row is terrible. It should be death week. But yeah, what you're seeing is some sort of attempt to like bring that back into the conversation. I'm like, well, this is the worst case to be anti-death penalty.
I mean, sorry, but don't try to get me to sympathize with somebody who did that. Who, like, burying somebody alive
the
is
killer.
One of
the guy who shot the cop. The guy who shot the cop.
Oh, Mumia.
Free
Mumia.
No, the one in Georgia. Troy Davis was his name or something.
I forget.
I played him on a radio sketch. I just remember that. We're supposed to be calling in from hell.
I don't know this one. Huh.
People were trying to say he was set up, but of course, yeah, only a crowd of 23 people saw him shoot the cop.
Yeah, oh, only.
Let's disregard their testimony. Well,
they're,
it was racism.
They're all racist, John, you know?
Well, yeah, and the entire crowd was black. That was the thing. Against him. And then people were trying to claim it was a setup
by the man.
Their
house, their Uncle Tom's, you know?
Right. Jesus.
Their tools for the white state.
Yeah, it was insane. You know,
need to get Al Sharpton up here to incite some arson.
Well, what they'll do is they'll report on it, and they'll never tell you what the crimes are. They catch a phantom killer and say, okay, he's 90 years old. He's going to go to the death penalty. You know, he's going to go to death row. It'll be like, no. You know, we don't have a right. He's in a wheelchair, you know.
I will say, like, you know, I wasn't thinking, like, I was like, when they said Zodiac, I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. But then the Zodiac killer did wear that fucking ridiculous costume when he killed that couple.
He was a strange dude. But I think what they figured out to be the age of the Zodiac, he would have been, like, maybe 13, 14 when the Phantom Killer was rampaging.
Right, yeah.
Little, and the Phantom Killer, as far as I know from my readings, did not send letters to the newspaper or anything. He didn't
have this this sort of ego thing.
Zodiac, you know, was more of a publicity whore. Like a lot of people think that, okay, Jack the Ripper wrote to the papers. I remember John Douglas said he didn't think those letters written to the paper were by Jack the Ripper until they sent the organ or something. You know, he sent a heart or something like that. Zodiac, in Zodiac's case, he sent like a bloody piece of the cab driver's shirt. The Phantom Killer or the Moonlight Murderer, whatever you want to call him, never tried to make a name for himself. Even the Irons that we talked about a couple of episodes back, he had communicated with the media.
He had?
Yes. He had apparently sent some letters, and I think either the letters have been lost or some cop has them like on file. But he did send letters to the newspaper.
Yeah, it's funny, like, you know, when you read about...
And he made those phone calls. Like, there's no talk about the Phantom Killer making phone calls.
No, there's not. If he did do that house, that home invasion, there's a strange progression to his crimes. You know, all of a sudden they stopped. You know, it kind of makes you wonder. Whenever there's a rash of killings and they suddenly stop, you kind of wonder what stopped it.
Right.
Because somebody who goes on to... somebody who's like that, they have this urge to do what they do. It's very strange. I don't know.
Yeah, and the thing is, we only know that psychology from the ones we've caught.
Exactly.
And that's why it's still kind of a baffling thing. Like, you know, before BTK was caught, there was a lot of talk about, oh, serial killers don't have a cooling off period. Well, BTK did.
Yeah, he did.
But he did have these kind of one-off murders that nobody ever linked to him. Mm-hmm. You know, like an old woman in the neighborhood, and he just murdered her. You know, it was strange, but it's like, but he's one you caught. It's like the ones you don't catch are the ones that have all the answers, you know.
The ones that are elusive.
Right, and when this movie was made, there was no such thing as the serial killer.
No, that term hadn't even entered the lexicon.
Fanaticism or whatever the hell it is.
What was it? What made this killer such a sensation was one of the cops described him as a sex maniac, and the press ran with that. And so it became, and that was like a really novel thing, a sex-crazed killer.
Right.
Like, you know, that freaked people out because he wasn't really a terribly sexual killer, although the commentary did suggest that he had violated a woman with a gun the first
time. Oh, I thought he raped the first victim.
Oh, really?
But back then, they didn't put it in the paper. They just didn't put that stuff.
Okay, because they were acting like, when I listened to the commentary track, I didn't get the impression she was raped. I got the impression she was violated with a pistol.
Right.
Which, you know, is a sexual crime.
But yeah, that was the idea, that she was raped. Yeah. So it's like, but they said beaten in the newspaper.
So,
you know, because 1940s journalism, they just didn't put details like that in the paper.
No, it wasn't.
Because everybody was going to know who the victim was. You know, it's a small town.
In a small town like that, everybody knows.
Yeah, everybody knows who it was. So
actually, like, you know what's funny? Well, not really funny, but you know what's interesting is, like, some of these victims, the age disparity, the second couple, I think it was, that was murdered, mm-hmm. like, the girl was 17 and the dude was 29.
No, it was the good old days. Everybody was the same age when they courted. Yeah, I know. It was.
I was just like, whoa.
That's more of a southern thing, I think. Although yeah. I've noticed it up north. You know,
and I've known I know some people who in the South who have grandparents who had that. Grandpa was 27, and grandma was like 16 when they got married.
Yeah, it's not that unusual.
No, it wasn't like that. Today it's creepy, but back then that was pretty normal. Because I know people whose grandparents, they had that age difference. They're still together and stuff. But
back then, here's what people forget, because they don't think of perspective back then. Mm-hmm. And I know they tried to start this hubbub trying to throw spears at, Phil Robinson and Duck Dynasty, because Miss K, his wife, was young when they got married.
Oh, yeah.
And he was caught out there. Oh, he said, you know, marry these women when they're young. Well, that was the belief back then, because back then, 9 times out of 10, you probably weren't going to go to college. You already had your job at the factory or the garage, or maybe you had a job at the city that was already you could already speak for it. And your next thing was going to raise a family. You didn't have that singles scene. That's a fairly new phenomenon in society.
You couldn't go to the club, baby.
You didn't stay unmarried till you were rarely unmarried past the age of 24.
I'm 29 and I'm not married and I feel weird about it.
Right, and you didn't...
I don't like being single at this age. I really don't.
Right, and Social Security was like a new thing and all that stuff. The idea, most people thought they were going to die by the time they were 60. It kills me how people never think of the perspective back then.
Right.
It's just that, no, you were going to start having a family and a lot of people had 4 or 5 kids. So it was better to start when you were like 17. You know, women wanted to get married because they were all going to be homemakers. They didn't go to the city and
they didn't,
you know, live glamorous jobs.
They weren't reading Gloria
single.
Steinem.
Right. That didn't exist. It was just like, no, your job was to be, you were going to be a wife. And you were going to be a
man
housewife.
Who has a job.
And housewives, they'd say it, they were happy. You know, that's the way society was. So
now, John, you can't say that.
Oh, that's right. But no,
Gavin McInnes proved you can't say that. said that, and boy, oh boy, that HuffPo Live conversation melted down really quick.
Well, people hate being told anything like that, but that was the truth. They weren't all pill popping like you're reading these John Updike novels. It's just like silliness. This kind of self-loathing that society's into now is just like kills me.
Mad Men.
Yeah, I mean that show is so friggin' inaccurate. It's like hilarious.
Oh, did I ever tell you the story about when my dad decided he wasn't sure about a girl my sister was a boy my sister was dating? a boy. He was like, you know, 20 something at the time, but
right.
He brought season one of Mad Men over to show to my dad, and he showed my dad the first episode. And, you know, of course, that show really plays up, like, you know, misogyny and racism and stuff.
Right.
And he turned to my dad and goes, boy, life sure was great back then. And he said it with, like, all seriousness. And my dad was sitting there going, you know, you shouldn't be saying that to me. Boy, life was great back then.
When I tried watching that show, I watched the first season, and I was like, well, this is just like feminist or young women writers who think they're feminists giving their perspective of what they think things were like back in the
60s. Right. I've only
based
seen
on what
episode.
They read in Gloria Steinem, you know, which is not, sorry, not terribly accurate.
No.
It's
the only
like,
feminist
if I watch
writer I like
movies.
Is Camille. The only feminist writer I like is Camille Paglia. Thank you.
Right, right. And I can't remember what she thought of that show, but I
she
trust
has,
her.
She's too busy watching Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Right, right. She loves that stuff. But... there's a Scott Laughlin essay about Mad Men that just tears it a new one.
Yeah.
And any time I post it, it pisses off fans of that show so much, they say the same thing. He's probably just some bitter writer that didn't get a job on the show. Well, I guess he struck a nerve, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because you know? It's like, no, he's actually some physicist or, you know, out in Berkeley. It's like he doesn't care.
He doesn't
it's
care.
It's like he just wrote this because this is how he observed the show.
Oh, my gosh.
Apparently he insulted it. It was published in Talkiebag, but I found it as Amazon.
Review. Oh, I know the article you're speaking of.
Yeah, and he totally nails it on all its inaccuracies. And that's the funny thing is when I watched The Town That Dreaded Sundown, I didn't spot anything that rang false, you know, other than what you sent me with that photo frame before we started recording the show, where you caught on your Blu-ray a cameraman filming Ben Johnson.
There's the shootout at the end where the train goes by and the killer evades them by running past the train.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Johnson and Andrew Prine's character are firing under the train tracks, trying to hit him. And there's a slow motion shot and you see the train going by and you see a cameraman like clear as day sitting there on the train filming them. I was watching it. This time I just noticed it and I paused it and I took a picture and sent it to John. I was like, what the hell?
It's kind of like when I'm watching a kung fu film that was like made in Taiwan and sometimes I'll kind of notice what looks like a car in the background.
Oh, yeah.
It's supposed to be a period piece, but they shot it in some park that had a driveway.
What was it? When Fellowship of the Ring was in the theaters, there was a shot where you could see a car drive by in the background. They erased it digitally on the Blu-ray DVD, but there was like, oh, look, there's a vehicle driving through Middle Earth.
Or it's, what would Stu say? Fucking Kiwis.
Fucking Kiwis. Okay. Stu's more mad at the Maoris right now, I think.
Yeah, but it is funny with all the worthwhile movies that Scream Factory has reissued. This is the only one I've purchased.
You know, they've put out some other stuff that I've always wanted to see but had a hard time finding, like Body Bags, which did get a DVD release, but you had to pay out the nose for it because it went out of print pretty quick.
Yeah, and I've never bothered to see it, even though I thought I was a big Carpenter fan. Apparently I'm not because I've never seen Body Bags.
I picked it up immediately because I wanted to see it, and it's a fun little Tales from the Crypt. Type rip
yeah.
off, you know.
I think with me it's like, what do I want to buy and actually put on my shelf?
Sure.
It's starting to get to be a pretty elitist list of stuff that I'm holding on to.
Well, you know, I haven't bought a ton of the Scream Factory ones. I've gotten the movies I really love, like Phantasm 2.
Uh-huh.
But you know,
yeah, it is a fun movie.
I still need to get like, but there's some I've seen that I just don't feel the need to own, like, you know, like The Howling's not very good.
Yeah, I don't care for that film, and some people I really respect, they love it.
Yeah,
it's
same
favorite
here.
World
just like,
movie,
I don't get it.
It never hit me the right way.
You know, I never felt the urge to see Night of the Demons, which they put out.
That's a piece of crap.
You know, I'm a fan of From Beyond, but not enough to buy it on Blu-ray, apparently.
Yeah, I actually thought of buying one of the used MGM DVDs for like $3.
Right.
I mean, that was a good
film.
Transfer for 5 years ago.
Yeah. I've bought a few of theirs. I'm trying to think which ones I own. I have Halloween 3 because I like that movie a lot.
I cannot stand that film. And I do not know why you and others that I thought I respected. To know in and tell me it's better than the original.
I don't think it's better than the original. I just
and it's better than Suspiria, and it's better than everything.
I don't think it's better than Suspiria. I actually showed Suspiria to a friend the other day who did not get it at all.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I've only shown Suspiria to women I dated. And they loved it.
This was a friend who's a girl, not a girl I'm dating, but
okay.
She's a friend of mine, and she went, I want to see something scary. You know, and I went, okay, and I brought a few over, and I was like, here, let's do Suspiria. You know, I want to see how you react to it. And she said she thought it was like, she goes, this isn't real horror, this is just artsy nonsense.
It's funny because a friend of mine, he rented Suspiria because I was recommending it. He said he didn't really like horror films. I said, well, maybe you need to rent like the artsier ones. Yeah. And he rented it, and his Japanese wife was watching it with him, and she knew what the movie was right away.
I think I know who this is.
Because it was huge in Japan. It was a monster hit in Japan, and she had seen it when she was a little girl in the theater.
Oh wow!
And she was just blown away that he had rented Suspiria.
Nice.
And I think was Suspiria Deep Red 2 or was Deep Red Suspiria 2 and or something like that?
No,
I think
Inferno was Suspiria 2.
Okay, so I know that in Japan they had a weird retitling. I think Suspiria was called Deep Red 2.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think it was.
Because I know Inferno was the sequel, quote-unquote, to Suspiria.
Right, right. Inferno is officially a follow-up, but Deep Red was Deep Red 2, that was Suspiria's title, or Deep Red 2 Suspiria. But I think that's what she called it, or something. And he was just baffled, and he called me up, and I said, well, this is what I think happened. I probably got that all backwards, but I remember it was pretty funny, but it was such a hit in Japan. But it was mainly seen by women.
It is a very feminine movie. It's, you know, the ballet school. But what I love about that movie, and I was trying to explain this to my friend, was that I love the dream logic aspect of it. And the acting is kind of, you know, stiff, hackneyed, whatever. But the feeling, I was just riveted when I watched it again. I was like, man, this is a great film. Like, just the dream logic of it. Like that scene where she discovers the coven of the witches.
Yeah, well, I'm a sucker for like that great photography.
Oh, totally.
And I'm also a sucker for music perfectly in sync with the film.
Yes, I am too. But it just there were so many things in it that feel like dreams that I think are pretty universal. Like there's the scene where she looks down the hall and you just see the witches talking about her.
Yeah.
And drinking blood, like that feels like dreams.
There's also a lot of subliminal imagery in it too.
Yes.
So and every time I watch it, I always pick up on something new, and I'm like, whoa. And yeah, I've always liked that about it. But those are the type of films I like. That Sorcerer and these films that kind of match the visual with the music.
Sorcerer
like, that was really
is a
important.
Great one. That
kind of like that. Any pre MTV film where the director really thought about how the music was going to go with the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that's always. Sergio Leone westerns, you know, you can go on and on about.
Well,
that
Sergio
stuff.
Leone would have Morricone like record the music first, and then he would
right, right. That
the
was that was
it.
The legend. It's like after Fistful of Dollars, he started having to do that to where Once Upon a Time in the West, they were playing it on the set as they were filming.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I didn't know if that was true or not.
It was on. It was
story.
In Chris Frayling's book, so I'll assume it's truth. But you know, there's disputes to everything. But even like in Chinese films, Jimmy Wang Yu's masterpiece is independent masterpiece, the one-armed boxer versus the master of the flying guillotine, over here we call it the master of the flying guillotine. He used all this German krautrock and it's totally scored. You could hear you can hear Neu, you could hear like all this very cool German rock music. And because back when I got the tape, when I first got a copy of it, back when we would just trade copies and this came off of a British version, we all thought it was an original score done for the film.
Yeah, that's what I had thought, too.
It wasn't until Psychotronic Video had reviewed it, and I think Mike Weldon noticed, oh, it's got music from Can, and because he had all those records, so he recognized the music.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And when you watch that movie, it's just so awesome with the... you know, the blind master with the flying guillotine walks on screen and you hear, like, noise... you know, whatever the hell, Super 75.
So that's
75.
What that is. Okay, because I'm thinking of that music
like,
key right now. I think of when I think of Master of the Flying Guillotine, I think of that. By the way, my favorite bit in the dub is there's the guy fighting Wins Without a Knife, and he fights and he pulls out a knife and stabs the person, and they go,
yeah.
Oh, so he does use a knife.
Yeah, my friend Colin had always mentioned his favorite thing in Mad Monkey Kung Fu, a Liang film of great bad dubbing was, or just a great dub line, was like, they killed his monkey for no reason at all.
My favorite dub is Five Element Ninja, a.k.a. Chinese Super Ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
I can't use Kung Fu for about 3 months.
I must go into seclusion. I've been poisoned.
I am the leader of the ninjas. Now tell me your name.
I just remember, always remember loss of a fight means loss of a life for a samurai.
Oh, yeah!
But it's funny you call it Chinese Super Ninjas, because that was the bootleg videotape title. On TV, it was called Super Ninjas.
It's that when I got it initially, I got a bootleg of it, and it was called Chinese Super Ninjas.
Yeah, that was the bootleg title. It was Super Ninjas when it aired on television, because I remember when it used to air. Which, it was a weird mess on television. But
God, I need to watch that movie again. When I first got that bootleg, I watched it so much. I showed it to everybody.
I had a Black Belt Theater recording, but it was missing like some of the ninja segments because they were too, you know, they cut them up for time.
Oh, and they're gory as balls, too.
Yeah, I think the Sun Ninja scene was way too gory, and that was missing. So when I got the Vista pre-recorded, it actually came out of a legit pre-recorded in like 1988 or 87. That was fully uncut, and I must have watched that damn thing 20 times.
And
the irony was, it was time compressed, so their voices were actually higher pitched, and the fights moved a little too fast. So,
was it when I was watching my bootleg copy? They finally put out a proper. I think Media Blasters put out Five Element Ninjas.
Yeah, they put out a great one. I had a
beautiful
celestial
transfer.
Yeah,
but the bootleg I had a lot of the gore cut out. Like, it was still a really gory movie. But I didn't realize how gory it was until I saw the Media Blasters version. There was a
lot. Oh, wow. I wonder if they used a TV print or they used like a censored print from Germany.
Maybe.
Or something.
But that's one of my absolute favorite Chang Chang.
Because the Germans used to cut the gore out. Like, I was iffy about getting the Town That Dreaded Sundown bootleg that was around because I was thinking maybe the French cut something.
Bringing it back to Town That Dreaded Sundown, the most infamous sequence in that movie, the bit where he attaches the pocket knife to the trombone.
Yeah.
And kills the girl with that. That scene is really scary.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene could have easily been, like, hilariously bad. When you watch it.
Yeah, and for some reason it isn't funny at all.
No, it's not funny at all. In fact, like, the noises the guy makes, he almost sounds like the samurai. Like, when he puts it on, he's like, whoo!
Yeah.
And it's just, you could just see this pitch coming, this girl's tied to this fence, and you're just like, ugh. It's really frightening.
It was an excruciating scene.
But, like, this... It's such an insane idea. You know, it has no basis in reality. The girl was was a saxophone player.
Right.
In real life. But, and I think she was actually played by, she was. She was played by Pierce's wife at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an insane idea that it could go so wrong so easily. But it doesn't. It's... And Justin Beam talked about it on the commentary. He said he saw it when he was a kid, and that was the scene that, like, scarred him, you know?
I remember when I saw that scene, when I first saw it as a kid, I just thought it was weird.
Well, and he said that...
And then when I saw it later, I was like, oh, man, this is pretty intense.
Well, he said he saw that, it scarred him, but he didn't know what the movie was called. And he said for years he, like, would describe it to genre fans, and he said, you know, oh, maybe it's, like, Night of the Scarecrows or something, like, some with a hooded killer. But he said eventually he found that film. But
which is funny because there's no in the original Night of the Scarecrow TV movie, there's no hooded killer in it.
Well, maybe it's I'm thinking of a different
The Scarecrow appears movie. As a ghost at the end, and that's kind of it.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different Scarecrow movie, and I'm just misreading.
Oh, there was a thing called Scarecrows, or I think there may have been a movie called Night of the Scarecrows or something.
Yeah, because I remember there is one with Scarecrow in the title that has, like, hooded something, but it's not the same.
Yeah, but the I would say Scream Factory did an amazing job with it. Like, and the commentary is good. I listened to it like back when it first came out.
You know,
really solid.
Justin Beam did a good job, like, moderating and just kind of guiding this, you know, historian, like, you know, just one of your local, like, Shelby Foote types through the film. And it's a really good commentary. And the movie's not that long, so it's not like a massive time investment, like, you know, some commentaries I've listened to lately.
It's also a clue into the raw talent of Charles Pierce. Like, we kind of laugh, like, it's stuff like the third Boggy Creek movie that he'd made that's became a Mystery Science Theater 3000 laugh fest or whatever. And some people will still insist, like, Legend of the Boggy Creek is a terrible film. Like, I posted some stuff, and people were like, ah, this movie was awful.
That movie has a cult following, though, I thought.
Yeah, and it's like, people are crazy about it, though. And so people who told me they saw it in the theater when they were kids, because they went to see it because it was G-rated, they said it scared the hell out of them.
You know, that's something that's missing today is the G-rated horror movie. We don't get those anymore. All movies aimed at kids are Pixar, DreamWorks.
Yeah, and in the old days, Godzilla movies were G-rated. That was mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Hammer films were G-rated.
Yeah. Well, and like even Disney made horror movies, like Watcher in the Woods, you know? Like,
well, I think that became PG. That was supposed to be the first PG Disney movie. It ended up being Devil and Max Devlin because Watcher in the Woods was delayed because they had to do reshoots. Or so. I forget what the story was, but it was announced like... There were posters like a year or two before it hit theaters.
But that was one that I know a lot of people who grew up around that time who were like scarred by Watcher in the Woods. You know?
Oh, I bet. It said, hey, it's a Disney, so how could it be bad?
Yeah, you know? but that's something that's missing from kids' movies today. I think kids like being scared. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, when I'd get scared, I'd be like, oh, but, you know, it was kind of thrilling. Right.
It's because it's raising the heart rate.
But that's kind of a lost thing is the horror movie aimed at kids that's supposed to scare kids that's okay but that doesn't have like tits or blood or something.
Well, they want to make it nerfy universe for children to grow up in,
which I hate. Like, you know, they have to blast the Lego movie soundtrack. Everything is awesome, you know.
Or Radio Disney. I mean, just the mere concept of that kids can't handle normal oldies radio.
And
it's going to be Radio Disney.
I know. I think it's like, do you think it's a symptom of like helicopter parenting? Like, what is it? Like, like just parents that have to wrap their kids in bubble wrap and, you know, we have to monitor everything they do
it's,
and be with them
it's
all the
time idea
and
that
turn
we
them
don't
into narcissists.
Well, we don't have collective communities or people watch out for each other.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, now...
We really don't have that anymore, and you don't have it where it's like kids go to somebody else's backyard and the parents are in touch because you had stay-at-home moms. And that was more organized, and, like, wife got a thing in the mail for be an Avon rep. I'm like, do they still have Avon reps? Because that made sense in the days of Housewives.
Yeah.
You had time for afternoon presentations and sales stuff, but nowadays people just order what they need off Amazon or... You know, go down to Walgreens, they'll have all they need. You know,
the thing
it's just
I see
like
modern, the dying breed of modern housewives doing is like, you know, Mary Kay or something.
Right. And that was the interesting thing about this movie is if you think about it, it's set in a time when people didn't watch television, certainly didn't have computers. Entertainment was being at home reading or listening to the radio.
And there was no rock and roll either. Like,
right.
The
and
band
you didn't
in the
have
movie's a big band. You know?
Right. They're listening to like Benny Goodman type stuff.
Yeah.
And they're playing like big band music. And it's strange. It's like you think back at that time and this type of murder is going on. And I don't even think he had 911 service.
No, probably.
Like,
not.
And the idea of the cops getting anywhere in like 5 minutes was laughable.
Well, they mentioned that being a cop back then was in a community like that was extremely stressful.
Oh, I bet.
Because you had so much ground to cover, like, because, you know, the forest wasn't huge. You had a lot of ground to cover. And plus, this was a border town, half in Arkansas, half in Texas, you know. And there was this cop there who said that work being a cop in, this historian brought up, he said, bringing a cop in Texarkana was more stressful than, the most stressful period in his life. And he had been in France in the war.
Like, oh, I bet.
Like, it was just, it was hard, like, stressful work.
Yeah. I bet it was crazy. And you think about them, they're totally untrained to handle a crime like this.
No, yeah, that's, you know, it took them a while to connect it, whereas today, maybe that wouldn't be the case, but...
You know, and it's like we talked about with Aaron's case, where it's like, okay, like Stu had mentioned, the cops had really screwed up the case, and it's like... But in a way, they weren't really ready for it. You know, this is a new type of offender and aggressive very high volume of crime. They just weren't ready for that.
Well, it's like, you know, people give the law enforcement in West Memphis a hard time for the West Memphis 3 thing, but, you know, the idea of children being, like, mutilated and murdered in the hills is just foreign. Like,
right, it's unheard of.
The cops there were just like, I don't know, you know, they didn't know how to properly do a crime scene there. You know?
Yeah, it was like, because that stuff didn't happen.
No.
It's like never happened before, so it's like, what are you going
to
do?
So, like, they were like, oh, the cops ruined the crime scene, and it, you know, led to these people being wrongfully imprisoned. Yeah, but they weren't thinking about that at the time. They were doing thought what they knew how to do. And
wasn't one of those kids being, like, a super smart ass?
No,
I watched one of those documentaries.
Yeah, no, Damien Eccles did not do himself any favors.
I didn't have the biggest sympathy for them at that time. I was just like, well, he's a smart ass.
No,
but,
he was trying to play up this persona that he had as this... you know, Aleister Crowley reading, you know, weirdo, and he would play it up in court.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's when you watch it, it's like, you are, you know, like, I don't think he did it, but he was being a know-it-all teenager, you know?
Right.
And that was not the situation. That was the most deadly situation that you could possibly be in and be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But... Such as, you know, teenagers, they think they know everything, you know.
Right. It was just such a weird, you know, I didn't find actually either of those films convincing. It's like, well, I don't know. This sounds like the defense's case, you know.
Well, my big problem with the second Paradise Lost movie is that it goes out of its way to make you think this other guy did it.
Right.
And, you know, that's the same kind of witch hunt mentality that they were condemning in the first film.
Exactly. I recognize that too, because I watched them back to back. Got them at the video store and watched them back to back, and I was just like, well, they're just basically framing this guy.
Yeah, I mean, and like, new evidence came to light that it was one of the other dads that, like, he's currently being investigated. They found his DNA and like, there's new evidence and all that. But, you know, this Byers guy wasn't even, you know, he wasn't a part of it. He was just clearly a mentally ill person.
Right.
And he was a mentally ill person stricken with insane grief, losing
his kid. That's crazy.
And then, like, there's a media circus, and he was, you know, performing for the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just, again, not a very bright person. But
well, people never think about the performing for the camera. Remember when the Washington Sniper was on the loose? Somebody claimed they saw a white guy in a white van.
Oh, yeah, it turned out to be a white guy, didn't it?
Yeah. Instead, it was like two black gay guys.
Yeah.
Two black gay Muslims, like, with the Washington Sniper. There you go.
that's a scary...
Well, nobody even talks about the gay aspect, but I'm like,
no,
why is a 20-year-old... Why is like a 19-year-old boy traveling around with a 30-something-year-old man?
Because they're fucking...
Well, that's not his father figure.
Because they're fucking...
It's like,
nuts,
please.
Why?
They're a couple. Yeah. Ugh. Stupid idiots.
Oh, yeah. Anyways...
But anyway, highest recommendation to getting this Blu-ray.
Yes.
I think this movie's really good. I don't know how it's going to play to the younger generation, younger than Hunter. I don't know if we have listeners that young. But
maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, as far as a southern environment, southern filmmaking, and the type of style and atmosphere you only get out of like a mid-70s film. Shot completely on location in Arkansas.
It's
you can't go wrong.
And it's also an influential movie on the genre, too. Probably.
Super influential and not really given a lot of credit for
no,
that.
No, it's not given much credit at all. But when you watch it, you're like, oh, this is... When you look at when it came out and you look at what came after, you're like, oh, well, this movie was really a trailblazer. Kind of the way Boggy Creek was, too.
Yeah, except for a spark plug.
Plugs. The parts of the movie, the humor really hasn't aged well.
No.
But the meat of the movie is really good. The setup, the stalking, you know, the horror scenes are really well done. It's not a very long movie. It's not a massive time investment. But the Scream Factory release is great. You have commentaries, interviews, and you get a copy of The Evictors on DVD with it.
Yeah,
so
it's a deal.
You're getting a 2-for-1 special here.
Right. Not a lot of deals that good in DVDs these days, especially Blu-ray. So
yeah. All right, well, I think that's about it for this week. Stuart will not be joining us next week. He was found in the Yaba. He had lost a boxing match with a kangaroo, And so he is currently recovering from that, and he will not be back next week, but hopefully the next week we will have Stuart back and fully recovered from having his face pounded by a kangaroo and its Joey.
So, either that or he'll be at the Men at Work reunion concert.
Yeah, the Men at Work reunion, possibly. What's something Stuart's been ranting about this week?
Everything and anything.
Everything. Stuart's Facebook feed lately has been a stream of vitriol.
Well, it's because Garrow's trolling him.
He's like, hey Stuart, Lightning Jack, what a great Western.
Then Stu posts it up and goes, this is what I'm done with Amazon.
Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, but it's just funny, like, Stuart has had, I don't think I've heard Stuart say one nice thing on the internet in the past week. It's fun.
Yeah, he's, you know, the eagerness to have his home theater done, so.
I think once the construction's done on his home, he's going to be a lot happier.
Right.
After it was destroyed by an army of angry kangaroos, after he disrespected a member of their tribe.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, Stuart. Anyway, we'll be back next week, everybody. Anything else you have to add, John?
No, nothing new for this week.
All right. Well, swag and adios.
Mahalo.
Boom.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.